Maybe you should all come a bit closer. That way I wouldn't have to use the microphone at all.
You can introduce yourself.
Sure, or you want to, or whatever's protocol.
You'll do it better. I'm not very
familiar. Okay, well, hi, I'm Elizabeth Reed Steer. I'm originally from Australia, but I now live in the US. And back in the very early 90s, I was running the Australian Hub IRC server, so I've come today to give you a little history of IRC, which is mostly a big soap opera. I'm not going to give a technical history. It's just a history of all the interpersonal conflicts and, well, bitch fights that have contributed to the development or sometimes lack of it of internet relay chat. So first of all, has everyone here used IRC? Does anyone not know what it is? Okay, the baby doesn't, but I'm not sure he's going to understand me. Or she? She. So everyone knows what it is. I don't need to go through that explanation. Okay. I also should put in a note about pronunciation. I realised when I was preparing this talk that there are a great number of names and so on that I'd never said out loud. So if anyone has a different pronunciation that they prefer, you know, feel free to correct me or not, as the case may be. And I should also say that most of this talk is based on my own memories of IRC, and I've checked a lot of the names and dates with people, but you know, anything that's based on memory is bound to be imperfect. So if anyone can offer any corrections, that'd be fantastic. And also, I'm going to mention a lot of names, but in some cases I'm going to purposely omit names. Most of what I'm going to talk about happened over a decade ago, and some pretty foolish things were done, and on occasion some illegal things. So when I'm talking about those things, I'm just going to drop the names. So on with the history. Jaakko Oikarinen wrote the original IRC program at the University of Oulu in Finland in 1988. Now, at that time, he was working in the Department of Information Processing Science, and he administered the department's servers, which were connected to FUNET, the Finnish national network. One of the machines under his administration was tolson.ulu.fi, on which he ran a public access BBS called UluBox. In his spare time at the university, he decided to extend the UluBox BBS software. He intended to develop a suite of tools including Usenet-style discussion groups and a real-time chat system. And he began working on the chat system first. Yes? Let me see if it's on this.
Yeah, that's the correct spelling.
O-U-L-U. O-U-L-U.
Name of a city. Okay, thanks.
Oh, did I pronounce it?
No, it's Finnish.
Okay, Finnish in an Australian accent, whatever it works out as. So he began working on the chat system first. Before he began work, UluBox ran two communications programs. One was rMessage, which was used for two-person chats, and the other was MUT, M-U-T, or multi-user talk, which permitted conversations between multiple users. But he considered MUT to be pretty unreliable and meagre on features, so Jaakko decided to develop something better. His main inspiration was BitNet Relay Chat. BitNet, or the Because It's There network, or I'm told it's Because It's There, but I've also heard people refer to it as the Because It's Time network.
I heard the latter.
You heard the latter.
In that time.
Whatever it was.
No, so, I'm saying in the 80s, I heard.
Yeah.
Because It's Time.
Yeah. So BitNet began in 1981 with a link between Yale and the City University of New York. BitNet and the internet were separate networks. A few BitNet machines were also on the internet, so it was possible to send email from one to the other. But the interactive messaging features, which BitNet Relay Chat exploited, were exclusive to that network. At that time, the internet was largely restricted to military, government, and research work, while BitNet was more open to student use. At its height in the late 80s, BitNet connected 560 organisations within the US, including universities, high schools, government agencies, and industrial research centres. And it connected over 1,500 organisations from 49 countries worldwide. By contrast, networks based on the Internet Protocol were only just beginning to be connected up into what we know today as the Internet. Two of the services which made BitNet popular were the listserv mailing lists, which we still see on the internet today, and BitNet Relay Chat. In August of 1988, Yahoo released the first version of IRC. From the user's point of view, Internet Relay Chat was very similar to BitNet Relay, sharing many of the same commands as well as the same channel-based structure. IRC was an immediate hit on Ulubox. Mind you, when I say it was a hit, I'm still talking about a very small number of users. At that point, the number of concurrent users was rarely more than 10, and fewer than 20 people had access overall. So toward the end of 88, you know, just soon after he released the first version, Yahoo completely dropped the idea of improving the Ulubox BBS software, and he began concentrating on developing IRC as a distributed network of chat servers. He asked some friends of his at the Helsinki University of Technology and Tampere University of Technology to start running IRC servers. At that time, FUNET was part of NorgiNet, which connected countries throughout Scandinavia, and the first international IRC link was between Finland and Sweden, and thereafter links were established to Switzerland, Norway, and for a short time, Poland. Toward the end of 88, NorgiNet was linked up to the United States as part of the growing trend toward international links between internet protocol networks. One of the first things to spread out from Finland to the rest of the world was IRC. Making use of the brand new link to the United States, Yahoo got an account on ai.ai.mit.edu. He didn't run IRC itself on AI, but he did chat to other AI users about it. The first non-Scandinavian user was Mike Jacobs, whom Yahoo gave an account on Ulubox. Another of the first users was Subramanian, to whom Yahoo not only gave an Ulubox account, but also a copy of the IRC server source. Vijay passed IRC on to Jeff Trim at the University of Denver and Todd Ferguson at Oregon State University. They had contacted Yahoo after being told about IRC by Vijay, and early in 1989, orion.cair.du.edu and jacobcs.cd.orst.edu became the first US IRC servers. Now, this is a period when the dates are pretty vague. Yahoo says that he definitely released IRC in August of 88, and there are some events in 1990 that I have a definite date for, but much of what happened in 89 is difficult to date, and sometimes the memories of the people I've talked to who are around at the time do conflict. Now, I've done my best to sort out these conflicting timelines, but if anyone has actual documentation as opposed to just memory, you know, I'd really like to hear about it. So within a matter of months, IRC spread further, and by mid-89, the countries on the IRC were Australia, Canada, Finland, Israel, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United States. By July 89, there were 38 servers internationally serving a peak of 12 users. So quite often there were more servers than users on the network. In 1989, Yahoo began to share development of both the server and client software with others. The primary and, I believe, at that time the only, though I'm not certain of that, but the primary client was IRC2, which was developed by Michael Sandroff at Carnegie Mellon University. Yahoo's successor in server development was Darren Reed, known at IRC as Avalon. Darren lived, in fact, still lives in Melbourne, Australia, and in 1990 he was a computer science student at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. Avalon's inheritance of the server was not without opposition. At the beginning of 1990, a testnet for server development was briefly set up. Numerous people worked on server development, including Mike Bolotsky, Chris Davis, Chelsea Ashley Diamond, Armin Gruner, Tom Hopkins, Greg Lindell, Darren Reed, Helen Rose, Marcus Savella, and Bill Wisner. And those are basically the people whose memories from early postings and so on and email that I've been relying on for all of this. During the development of version 2.3, the developers started arguing about copyright. Chelsea Diamond wanted everything copyright to the IRC Development Committee, while everyone else wanted it released under a GNU public license. 2.3 was released with Chelsea's copyright, after which she was excluded or booted out from the development team, and subsequent releases were all GPL. The time between the release of 2.3 and the first of the Avalon releases, which was 2.6, was a matter of months. In those months, the test network was disbanded, partly because of interpersonal arguments relating to the copyright issue and partly just due to interpersonal arguments of a more personal nature. With the support of Yarko, Helen Rose and Chris Davis, the three of them supported Darren Reed being the primary and, well, only server developer. Darren and Yarko would later, that was in 1993, they would co-author RFC 1459, the original RFC describing the IRC protocol. One of the first features to be added by Avalon were alphabetically named channels, in which the channel name was prefixed by a plus sign at that time. Plus channels were introduced in version 2.6. Previously, all channels were identified just by numbers. Alphanumeric channel names permitted considerably more imaginative channel descriptions. In version 2.7, the plus sign was replaced by a hash sign. Numeric-only channels were disallowed. In later versions, ampersand channels were introduced. You know, plus channels came back, but today it's pretty much just hash channels. The rivalry over server development spread to arguments amongst IRC server administrators about how the network itself should run. The arguments took place on OpperList, a mailing list for IRC server administrators and operators. Previously, new servers had joined the network pretty much by contacting the administrator of an existing server and asking for a link. Which existing server a new server was linked to was primarily a matter of who happened to be friends with who. There was no thought of planning an efficient network topography. By July 1990, IRC had hit 100 servers, and as the number of servers grew, some people began to say that things such as, say, ping times should be given greater weight than friendship when deciding how to arrange the network. The leaders of the routing plan movement were Greg Lindell, Helen Rose, and Chris Davis, and Jay Lebov, who is sitting down there, was the administrator of a server at CMU, and he proposed switching IRC to a privileged port, which would mean that IRC servers could only be run by someone with official sanction from the organisation owning the machine the server was on. As it was, IRC used ports 6666 and 6667, though it could run others as well. Those ports didn't require special privilege, and thus anyone who wanted to run a server could do so. The ability for anyone to run a server wouldn't have mattered quite so much had it not been for the administrators of servers at eris.berkeley.edu and slowpoke.mlb.semi.harris.com. Eris and Slowpoke had wildcard server lines, meaning that anyone who set up a server could connect to Eris or Slowpoke without needing to get a specific server link line. People began to hook up servers with the intention of disrupting the network. Two of the most popular tricks played by these server operators were to set up a band line in their server configuration against a particular user, or to create a NIC collision. Just a quick explanation of what a NIC collision is. On IRC, usernames or NICs have to be unique, so no two users connected to IRC can have the same NIC. And if two servers connect and they find that each of them has a user with identical nicknames, both users are disconnected from IRC. People were setting up servers, connecting to them using NICs that were currently on IRC, and then connecting their server to the wider network via the wildcard servers, resulting in massive nickname collisions and attendant disruption of the network. The idea of switching IRC to a privileged port was fairly quickly rejected, primarily because many of the server admins were students who feared that it would not be possible for them to get official permission to run a server, or feared that if IRC were officially approved by the university, then responsibility for the server would be taken away from them and given to the officially employed administrators. None of the admins wanted to risk losing their position, and consequently the debate concentrated on routing plans and opposition to the open server lines on Eris and Slowpoke. The Eris and Slowpoke admins staunchly supported their open connection policy. They had their own plan for the future of IRC, which was to have a small number of central servers, of which Eris would be the chief, to which other servers could freely connect without any passwords or permissions being required. Now, the supporters of this plan referred to the proposed network as AnarchyNet, or ANET. Numerous other people demanded that the open server lines be removed, and eventually Greg Lindell forced the issue. He, Helen Rose, Chris Davis, and several other server admins queue-lined Eris and Slowpoke. A queue or quarantine line means that the server with the queue line won't permit the queue line server to connect, and it will also drop the connection to any server which is still allowing connections from the queue line server. All of the major hub servers queue-lined Eris and Slowpoke and more or less forced everyone else to go along with the plan as a condition of retaining their own links. As a result, IRC split into two networks. 15 servers with a peak of about 50 users formed ANET, and 95 servers with a peak of around 100 users formed the Eris Free Network, or EFNet. Eris was mentioned since the admin there had been more vocal than the Slowpoke admin in his opposition to removing his open server line. ANET survived for a very short while, mostly with Eris as a lone server, while EFNet continued to grow and is one of the main IRC networks in use today. Now, I'm not entirely sure how long ANET did survive. Some people have said 3 years, others said it was a matter of months. At the time when I started using IRC, which was late in 1990, I wasn't aware of any ANET servers, so I don't really know what happened to them. So this brings me to when I appeared. It's a bit of personal history. In late 1990, I was finishing up the last year of my Bachelor of Arts at the University of Melbourne in Australia. I'd barely used a computer then. I mean, like most of my fellow students in the humanities departments, I was just using pen and paper. You know, I'd occasionally used a computer as a glorified typewriter. But one day I started sharing a house with a friend who ran a BBS, and I quickly became addicted to the BBS. Started calling around to other BBSs, and someone on one of those told me about this thing called the internet. And I was told it was basically just a huge BBS for universities. So I went along to the department, the English department that I was in, and I said, you know, what's this internet thing? How do I get it? And they stared at me blankly and said, we have no idea. So I went off to the main library and asked the same thing, and they didn't know. But one librarian said, well, he thought it was something they did over in computer science and engineering. So off I went to the engineering department, and I basically bullied someone to tell me what it was all about, and ended up sitting down in a lab full of sons, sitting there looking at this thing called the internet, wondering, you know, what do I do? You know, I'd never seen Unix before. So I turned to the person next to me, and I asked what it was all about, and that person turned out to be Daniel Carazzoni, who was known as Woftem on IRC. Dan showed me email and Usenet and so on, and then he took me down to the local pub to meet a group of his friends, and among that group was Darren Reed, or Avalon, the main server developer. Darren told me all about IRC, and I was hooked. At that time, Darren was doing all his server development out of a guest account at the Australian National University in Canberra. He had a friend who was a sysadmin there, and Canberra was some 300 miles away from Melbourne, and the network link was even longer because it was routed through Sydney University, which was 400 miles from Melbourne. And unfortunately, Darren didn't have the authority to set up a server at RMIT because he was an undergraduate student, and he was trying to convince somebody at Melbourne University to run one, and that's where I came in. At that point, I had to put in a proposal for a thesis which I would write during the honours or fourth year of my degree. I was originally going to do it on BBSs, social behaviour on BBSs, but I switched my plans to writing my thesis about IRC as soon as I had been introduced to that. Now, Darren suggested that I get my thesis supervisor to write a letter to the main system administrator in the electrical engineering department and ask for an account there in order to do my work and for technical support in studying IRC. Now, this was quickly done. The letter was dictated by me to my supervisor based on a draft written at the pub by Daniel and Darren. The sysadmin over at EE, his name was Richard, he was also an IRC user, and he was more than happy to have this excuse to make IRC a legitimate activity at Melbourne Uni. So within a few works of my even hearing about the internet, I was officially administering a brand new IRC server at the University of Melbourne. Well, due to the letter from my supervisor, my name was on the pink slip of the server, but most of the actual work was done by Dan Carazzoni. So the upshot of all this was that Darren now had a local server that he could tinker with without the hideous net lag times he'd been coping with while working on the server through his account at ANU. Now, Dan and Darren soon proposed that irc.ee.mu.oz.au become the Australian hub server, a move which was supported by Helen Rose. Now, Helen and her husband, Chris Davis, were pretty much the king and queen of IRC at the time. And they kind of adopted Dan as I as their Australian subsidiaries. And my position was a little odd. You know, I had no technical background in computers, but at the same time it was official faculty approval of my thesis work, which was protecting IRC at Melbourne. And it was an in-joke amongst us all that this official support stemmed from a letter which had been written at the pub by Dan and Darren. So I ended up writing this thesis, which was titled Electropolis, Communication and Community on Internet Relay Chat, and I put it out in the internet, and I was really surprised at how many people started reading it. Now, as a piece of academic work, it was pretty average, but it had the distinction of being the very first academic study on social behaviour about social behaviour on the internet, the first study written by anyone. So as a result, I found myself doing things like radio interviews and going around to conferences, and I was even quoted in an article in Australian Playboy magazine, which will be fun to tell my children when they're older. Mummy was in Playboy. But back to the server situation. It was proposed that my server become the Australian hub. And at that time, the Australian hub server was at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and was run by Troy Rollo. Troy was a senior system administrator there, and early in 91, he had taken over development of the ERC2 client software. Now, he was a big player in IRC at the time, and he did some really wonderful work. However, he didn't want to give up his position as the hub server admin. Now, from a technical point of view, moving the hub to Melbourne made sense. Melbourne University housed the physical satellite link, which connected Australia to the rest of the world. But on the other hand, the University of New South Wales was at the end of a network arm which went from Melbourne Uni to Sydney Uni and then out to UNSW. So traffic between a Melbourne IRC user and an overseas user came in at Melbourne Uni, went up to Sydney, then to UNSW, back to Sydney, down to Melbourne. Darren set up a test server at Melbourne and connected it to Helen Rose's server at EFF.org. And ping times were an order of magnitude smaller than that of the official Melbourne server routed via UNSW. So with those numbers in hand, Helen and Darren convinced the rest of the US servers to cut their link to UNSW, install Melbourne Uni as the Australian hub, and force UNSW to link to Melbourne. Now, needless to say, Troy was not the least bit happy about this, and the incident started a feud between Troy, Darren and Dan and myself, which continued for... well, as long as I knew Troy. In 1993, Troy handed development of ERC2 over to Matthew Green, who is also at the University of Melbourne, and Troy all but left IRC to concentrate on other projects. In 1991, IRC gained new respect from system administrators who had previously derided it when, during the Gulf War, IRC became a chief meeting place and news source. Almost overnight, the peak number of users on EFNet grew from 100 to 300, with all of those extra 200 connecting to a Channel Plus report. Bandwidth statistics from the National Science Foundation from then show traffic of almost 9 gigabytes during February of 1991, compared to less than 2 gigabytes before the Gulf War. Users from around the world would log on to Plus Report and type in transcripts of local news coverage. The incident that sparked this use of IRC was the fact that although Iraq shut down radio, telephone and television links between Kuwait and the outside world, they neglected to shut down the internet link. So consequently, an IRC server operating in Kuwait remained functional for several weeks after other communication channels were cut off. Israeli IRC users also went online with their tales as missiles were launched against them. One of the most poignant moments, at least for me, because it was one of the few that I really witnessed myself, was when a 16-year-old Nathan Srebo from Haifa, he was too young to serve in the Israeli army, he typed reports into IRC as he described himself sitting in a sealed room with his mother and his younger siblings, all of them wearing gas masks. And IRC would continue to be used as a news resource during other episodes of international concern, including the 92 Russian Revolution, the Los Angeles riots, and the Oklahoma City bombing. The Gulf War signalled something of a coming of age for IRC. Many of the server operators began to feel that they should formalise organisation of IRC. Many new servers had joined the net during the war, primarily run by system administrators as opposed to students. These system administrators were employed by universities who wanted IRC access specifically for its value as a news source. This was especially the case in Europe, and it led to the formation of the European Board of IRC Coordinators. The EBIC developed a series of simple management directives describing the process by which new servers should be added, lines allocated, and IRC operators chosen. After the EBIC guidelines came out, Helen Rose, Chris Davis, Dan Carazzoni, and I attempted to institute a similar set of rules in the US and Australia. Initially, Helen referred to this effort as the plan. And after a while, this was replaced by the terms US Board of IRC Coordinators, or USBIC, and AusBIC for Australia. The main concern was network routing, since the current network topology was pretty inefficient and net splits were becoming far too frequent. Hardly an hour would go by without significant server connections breaking, cutting the EFNet into multiple pieces. Now, unfortunately, the plans we wrote up were just hideously bureaucratic. Now, the EBIC directives on which ours were based were very brief. The EBIC thing was less than a page long. But we wrote on for months and months, getting into increasingly more minute detail about procedures to deal with every possible eventuality and technical difficulty. Now, we devised all these elaborate voting systems and steering committees. Now, I remember Daniel sitting up all night writing these turgid tomes. And not surprisingly, the USBIC and AusBIC plans were wildly unpopular with everyone else. Even the people who wanted some formalised rules about how to run the network absolutely hated the USBIC plans, and in the end, nothing was done to fix the increasingly chaotic EFNet. At the same time, Avalon, Darren Reed, was preparing to release version 2.8 of the IRC server. This new version was intended to resolve numerous technical issues and would be largely incompatible with previous versions. If 2.8 were introduced, it was going to be necessary for everyone to upgrade at once. And many server administrators objected to this, balking at the idea of being commanded to upgrade their servers, and many expressed doubts about the reliability of 2.8. The discussion about the proposed upgrade became so acrimonious that several people accused Darren of putting backdoors in 2.8, which would allow him to control any server running that version. These accusations led to such bad feeling that, and such paranoia on the part of the people opposed to the upgrade that a group of several IRC operators hacked into Darren's account at ANU with the express purpose of reading his email and looking for evidence of a conspiracy to plant backdoors in 2.8. Now, that's one of the times when I'm not going to mention names. And when this came out as a result of a security investigation at ANU, the already tenuous relationship between IRC server administrators went straight to hell. Several servers were queue-lined until replacement administrators could be found, and in the general outrage over the infiltration of Darren's account, the majority of server administrators did agree to upgrade to 2.8, and in return, Darren agreed to issue a patch for the 2.7 servers for those who really didn't want to upgrade. In order to preserve the compatibility across the network. Well, this was 10 years ago. We were all very young, and I think everyone who played a role in all those psychodramas, myself included, got a little too caught up in our sense of self-importance. Things got very emotional and some pretty stupid things were done. So as a result of all these problems, both technical and interpersonal, a new crop of alternative IRC networks began to emerge out of the dissension and dissatisfaction with EFNet. The first of these was TubNet, which emerged in June 1991 and which was devoted solely to flirtation and netsex. It was formed by a group of devotees of the Channel Plus Hot Tub who were irritated by the frequent net splits experienced on EFNet. TubNet lasted only a few months, as did several other small networks which sprang up. These small networks were referred to by some EFNet admins as vanity nets, implying that their administrators were motivated more by a desire for self-aggrandizement than as an IRC network operator than out of a concern for network efficiency or user service. You know, of course, the same accusations went the other way. Many of the small IRC networks were set up so that users could experiment with bots, which appeared on the IRC scene, I think, early in 91. Now, initially, bots, most of them were just a set of client scripts, ERK2 scripts, which are issued channel commands in order to lock out certain users and give others channel operator privileges. Bots evolved from there into a variety of types, including IRC services such as NickServe and NoteServe. The NickServe bot was designed to protect usage of IRC nicknames. You registered a nick with NickServe with a password. When you logged in, you identified yourself to NickServe, and anyone else who tried to use that nickname but didn't have your password would be harassed by NickServe into changing their nick. NickServe also contained a memo feature, which allowed users to leave short emails for other users, which would be messaged to the recipient when they connected. That feature was later split off into a second bot named NoteServe. For a while, these bots were seen as a useful addition to the IRC landscape, but they quickly became a nuisance. Channel wars ensued between rival bots whose owners wanted to control a particular channel. And as the number of IRC users grew, it became difficult to say who should own a particularly, you know, a particular nick that was quite commonly desired. At one point, it seemed that every second client connected to the IRC network was in fact a bot, and the strain on the network from this increased load was beginning to show. Anti-bot sentiment grew, and it reached its peak when destructive bots entered the scene. These bots would attempt to break a client's connection to the network by flooding the client, and even worse, bots began to appear which would flood servers and cause net splits. The first successful alternative network was the Undernet, which was formed soon after the incendiary release of server version 2.8 and during the debates about USBIC. In October 1992, Daniel Mitchell at the University of Oklahoma and Andrew Daniels of Indiana University set up a small test network and were soon joined by a handful of other servers. A similar server network for server and bot testing had been set up at the same time by Donnie Lambert at Dalhousie University in Canada and Laurent Demailly at the French National Centre for Scientific Research. In December of 92, these two small networks were connected into one. In February of 93, the name Undernet was coined to describe this new network, which by then consisted of 19 servers, including servers in the US, Korea, Japan, France, and Canada. Initially, this network was conceived as a cooperative effort of friends without any need for official policies and permissions processes. The following is from the first Undernet FAQ. They said, at the moment, the EFNet IRC is overloaded with users. There are frequent net splits involving not just the odd servers, but in increasing cases, a significant number of servers. Too much pressure is put onto the EFNet IRC due to the unforeseen explosion of users. Many people don't ask if the EFNet IRC will survive, but when it will go. There's another reason why the Undernet is here. EFNet IRC is becoming more and more politicised day by day. With various EFNet admins forming groups against one another, the amount of cooperation between them has become almost nil. The time which they could spend in serving the users is instead spent in endless bickering. Of course, you know, I was one of the ones participating in the bickering. By April of 93, despite these idealistic beginnings, several Undernet server admins attempted to take control of the network and force their chosen routing systems on the others, resulting in the remaining admins adopting routing plans and administrative guidelines not unlike EBICs. Now, ironically, considering the origins of the network, the use of bots on the Undernet became a matter of great debate. Ultimately, it would prove impossible to completely eliminate bots from any of the IRC networks, and efforts to contain them turned to developing clients and servers immune from their attacks and encouraging the use of bots only on specifically designated servers. The Underneters developed their own version of the IRC server based on Avalon's 2.8.10. The most important innovation of the Undernet server was the implementation of timestamps. This prevented mass nick collision kills by allowing servers to tell which of two identically named clients was the most recent. And in the case of a nick collision, the newer client would be killed, while the client which had had the nick longer was protected. This prevented deliberate attempts at nick colliding. After a somewhat rocky start due to the usual interpersonal conflicts between administrators, the undernet became extremely successful. Those who ran it were indeed able to agree on a more logical routing scheme than that seen on AFNet, and the modifications introduced to the undernet server resolved some of the problems plaguing AFNet. AFNet carried on in much the same way as before, with server upgrades always seeming to lag a few steps behind the latest problems posed by the growth of the network. The same old arguments seemed to regularly crop up on OpperList, and within 2 years, it was time for another outbreak of dissatisfaction leading to the creation of another daughter network. Dalnet, the third of today's big three networks, was formed in July 1994. Dalvenja set up a small test network, which was primarily used by his friends from the EFNet channel #StarTrek. Originally referred to as Dalsnet, the name Dalnet, with the DAL capitalised, was officially adopted at the end of 94. The Dalnet fact says that the network was created by a handful of devoted individuals who wished to create an alternative to the overburdened networks of the time. The introduction of channel and NIC protecting services in 1995 was centred around the idea that the users should have the right to govern their online experience without the fear of channel takeover or harassment. Now, interestingly, the Dalnet fact claims that Dalnet pioneered the use of the NICServe, ChanServe and MimoServe services, and this wasn't actually the case. NICServe was active on EFNet in 1991, and the features of Dalnet's MimoServe were present in the original NICServe and later on in NoteServe. In addition to reinstituting these methods of NIC protection, the Dalnet has also developed their own server versions. While the servers on EFNet limited NICs to 9 characters, the Dalnet server would accept 15-character NICs and later on 30 characters. Now, Dalnet's early popularity was to a large degree attributable to the release of the Windows IRC client MIRC, or MIRC, however you pronounce it. Dalnet servers were listed in MIRC's default server list, and because the list was arranged alphabetically, the Dalnet servers were listed before the EFNet servers, and this led to a flood of MIRC newbies arriving on Dalnet. Before the end of 95, Dalnet was seeing a peak load of 1,000 users, and organisationally, Dalnet, just like Undernet before it, very quickly adopted an official structure in which a board of directors, led by Dalvenja as the CEO, voted to determine major routing decisions. Meanwhile, over on EFNet, things were getting pretty hairy, what with the lack of any progress in resolving their technical and political problems. And in October of 1995, EFNet had grown to the point of hosting 15,000 simultaneous users. In February 96, after the game Quake was released, more than 15,000 people could be seen in the channel #Quake alone. The technical issues, which had seemed important when there were merely 100 simultaneous users, you know, in retrospect, they seemed like, you know, a minor inconvenience, you know, compared with what was going on in 96 and 95. It was becoming obvious that the technical measures to address these problems, which Avalon had implemented, were merely a stopgap, and that a greater overhaul of both the server code and the administration of the network was becoming necessary. There was also great disagreement on what role IRC operators and admins should play in the day-to-day chat activities of users. Toward the end of 95, two main factions formed centering around these issues, and the two factions pretty much divided at the Atlantic. Well, also on the Pacific. There were basically two areas of disagreement. The first was what technical strategy should be adopted to limit NIC collisions. On the US side of the factional division, there was support for undernet-style timestamps. The European and Australian faction, which included Darren Reed, favoured a different method known as NIC delay. The NIC delay system prevented the use of a NIC that had recently been used by another client, recently typically being defined as 15 minutes or so. On the issue of the role of IRC operators and administrators, the Euro-Australian faction favoured limiting operator actions to those strictly concerned with routing and not interfering in user conflicts. The US faction, however, passionately defended their right to slash kill users whenever they felt they were behaving badly, and I think it's pretty clear what my bias is there. There seemed no way to broach an agreement between the two factions. The disagreement was brought to a head by the tenuous nature of the single link that connected Europe and the US. The link was constantly going down, partly due to overload on the network and partly due to deliberate service quitting by some of the US operators. One night in early 96, the link was split by a US administrator, and the European admins just never connected it. Instead, they sent a post to the Opalist announcing that they were withdrawing from EFNet. In the days that followed, debate raged on Opalist as various admins tried to decide on which side of the split their server should fall. In the end, Europe, Australia, and Japan ended up on one side, with most other countries remaining on the now US-dominated EFNet. The Euro-Australasian network called themselves IRCNet, reasoning that since their network included the original IRC server at Tolson Ulu Phi, they could lay claim to being the IRC network. In addition, since Australia was part of IRCNet, this meant that Darren Reed was now developing the server in accordance with the wishes of that faction, which he was obviously a leader in. Nick Delay was implemented in the next Avalon release and was used on IRCNet. EFNet would later adopt timestamps. It was at this time that I left Australia and moved to the US. I left IRC behind me when I moved, so that pretty much brings me to the conclusion of the history that I had any actual memory of. And in fact, I hadn't locked onto IRC for nearly 5 years until I downloaded Merck in order to do some research for this presentation. And I was quite amazed by how things had developed. Each of the four main IRC networks, EFNet, UnderNet, DialNet and IRCNet, typically have over 60,000 users on them at peak times of the day, and the highest number I saw was 80,000 on EFNet. Each of the four networks have also adopted virtually identical administrative documents describing procedures for granting links and organising routing. There are dozens, possibly hundreds, thousands maybe, of smaller networks serving specific communities and interest groups. Now, despite its often turbulent history, Internet Relay Chat has been a huge success. So now I'd like to open up the session for some questions, and I'd also love to hear stories from anyone who used IRC in the early days. So,
hey, I was at Georgia Tech in the 80s, and I put on, I think, about the 10th IRC server. As I remember it, there were about five in the States and five in, I was thinking Finland, but you say one was Sweden and Right. Maybe there was Switzerland.
So when was that exactly?
Well, I had thought it was in sometime in 88.
Now, that's interesting because Jay also thought that IRC started earlier. And I know that Jaco said he released it in August 88. Maybe he's incorrect. Maybe it was August 87.
I'm guessing that he's correct, and it was either the fall of 88 or winter of 89 when I did this. But anyway, it was at Georgia Tech. I remember Bill Wisner is who gave me the codes to get connected. And I've been curious, when this was, so I'm glad to.
Right. I have that exact same T-shirt.
Oh, yeah, this is a piece of history.
Yeah, I remember when we ordered a whole bunch of them from overseas back in, I think it must have been 91 or 92, we ordered this whole crate of them to be sent out to Australia.
Mm-hmm. I remember Wiz, the Finns were hanging out in the Channel 42 back in those days, and we found out later it was a joke, but we noticed they would greet each other, noof noof, which is in pipe FF, if you don't see umlauts for your pipe character. I guess it was O. Huh. And we thought that was just a Finnish way of saying, hey, it turns out it means oink oink in Finnish. And they were just tricking us into saying nuff nuff to them. My name is Strick. And Strick, Strick. And yak.net, yak.net is my domain now. More recently, we were hosting the 2600 IRC server, and we got DOSed really bad. We were smurfed for about 4 hours and threw them off our network, which really hurt me. That was about a year ago to have to diss the IRC crowd, but it wasn't just me. It's other people had computers in our T1, and we couldn't stand that. So all these problems, the whole history of denial of services, you know, in the last 3 years or whatever, has really been tied around IRC. All these tools were built in order to split IRC channels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's not so much to split the servers, which doesn't work, but to throw off the people who had ops on those channels. You go after the individual users is the pattern that still works.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the talk. It was very good.
Thank you. I should just apologize. My who's who slide is not coming up for some reason. So.
What's your name? Jay Leboff. I ran also in one of those first 10 or so servers at Carnegie Mellon. I also remember it being sometime in late 1988, because I can specifically remember there being give or take 10 or 12 servers on the worldwide network, and routinely less than that number of actual humans using them, going back that far.
See, I was the only user here, and I lost my interest in some. It was just a time like that.
Yeah.
Remember GT Stratus, Dr. Tech, that engine?
Talking about the kinds of operator fights that people had and the inflated senses of self-importance, I have to plead guilty to that sort of activity back then also, and I was firmly in the U.S. camp of, if thou wilt behave, thou wilt be killed. But by the time I had graduated from school and left at the end of 1989, the big deal had been loss of any semblance of control on the network, and I really also separated myself from it for many years. I would pop in once in a while over the decade that followed, be fairly promptly disgusted and bail out again.
So probably the biggest failing of IRC is they never split the functionality of maintaining the namespaces, who has what nick and who's in what channel and who owns that channel, from the actual conversations going on in the channel. And this meant that it was always very difficult. I mean, as the net grew and as more people got on, it remained difficult to keep the servers connected on the most important information, which is who has these names, because they're also keeping up with all this flood of traffic of everybody talking to each other.
And so what's happened latterly with dealing with those kinds of problems? Anything, or is it?
Lots of little experiments. As far as I know. I've got friends that are working on it. I've known friends who 5 years ago tell me they were working on it.
Right.
And we got the problem now within the Yak is my hacker crowd. We've got the people who steadfastly stick to EFNet because that's where their friends in the CDC are, and that's where their friends in GaySF are, and that's where, you know, whatever else. And that's the big city. You know, that's where people want to be. But we have such problems getting connected to it, and we get K-line from it and all these other problems that we have these other little networks set up. So I've got a robot now that logs into different networks and just bridges my one channel. And that's its only function. And that's kind of what's going on in my community, is which one do you get on? And let me pass it back to him.
Well, more recently, unfortunately, EFNet has gotten a little hard-nosed about people who've been screwing with their networks. They've been actually kicking servers off of EFNet. The biggest one was Comcast. Comcast no longer supports EFNet. They were totally kicked off. Comcast is no longer allowed to have an EFNet server. They had 12 or so of them, and they've just been getting nuts. A lot of people have when that started happening. It was about 4 or 5 months ago, but I can also see that they were getting a lot of people going into EFNet from Comcast and really hurting the network. It was dropping all the time. I know we switched SE2600 from EFNet to UnderNet around that time because it was impossible to log on. I mean, you'd log on, you'd be on one server, and that's all you could get to, total, complete net split. A lot of people migrated over to UnderNet or to Dalnet, which Dalnet has its own problems. They've adapted some new things of people are registering, allowing them to register their nick. And if you log on, you absolutely can't use that nick. You'll get a little sign that says they aren't logged on, but you cannot use that nick. Please change it in 15 seconds or we'll boot you. Which is unfortunate because I found Dalnet, as far as server software, has some of the best written server software. At DEF CON, I set up a huge Bahamut server farm. For people to go in and use. We were setting up as many services as we could, and I found Bahamut to be the most stable and the most secure, which is what Dalnet, administrators wrote just for Dalnet. But that's more more recent stuff that's been going on.
So you're saying it's become very difficult to find a unique nick to use?
On Dalnet, yes, because people are registering them. They're allowing people to register their nick so no one else could ever log on and use that nick. The same thing with rooms on Dalnet.
Most of the people are used to FNET and the older networks that had the 9-character restriction for their NICs, so they're still trying to get all these short NICs. FNET's gone to pretty much hell in a handbasket because they tried to fix it, but all of the script kiddies, it's now become a packet warrior heaven because all the script kiddies, when they tried to implement all these modifications to try and defend this, every packet warrior on the network continuously DDoS'd the network for, I think it was a month and a half straight. 75% of the servers couldn't keep connected. At that point, about 10 to 20% of the servers all just said, forget this, we're going to pull out. Mm-hmm. Recently, they had another situation where they had one individual that was DDoSing all of the servers continuously with over, I think it was 20 megabits worth of bandwidth per server. This was one individual that pulled this. At that point, 7 major ISPs that were supporting FNET as networks decided to just pull their connection and not reconnect. The SC2600, they moved to UnderNet. UnderNet's a lot better. They register channels. It's more of a role-playing chat-type organization. You don't have a lot of the script kiddies. I jumped over to openprojects.net, which is the open-source coders community. You find a lot of the programs that are like Linux, OpenBSD, FreeBSDs, all of those are on there, mostly for a information exchange. But FNET has been struggling so hard to try and get themselves back together, and it's impossible because the people that are on there are there for nothing more than warriors.
How does UnderNet deal with ownership of NICs?
They don't have any NIC ownership at this point. They've thought about it. The administrators, but that's because of the fact that their control of the control of the servers are by NIC on UnderNet.
One thing I haven't liked about UnderNet is they've more recently within the last many months have adopted a administrator world broadcast message, and they use it a lot. Today is so-and-so's birthday, and it's like, so? I don't know these people.
I remember when it was taken out.
So instead of setting up an administrator's room, they're using a world wall message to blast it out over everybody. It's getting very annoying, and they're abusing it more and more.
Why did they bring it back?
Set yourself -W. You won't see those messages. It's a wall-out message. It's optional.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but they're abusing it on UnderNet a lot.
They use it as a chat forum.
Yeah.
But it's hilarious, some of the messages they sent across.
Just to point out that we never completely forget our own inflated senses of self-importance. Let me see, this is 2001, so 12 years ago, give or take, I was trying to push the then network of possibly 25 servers to being designed technically in a way where you could only run the network with some degree of formal oversight. You'll notice that nobody complains about, say, the AOL Instant Messenger or the Yahoo Instant Messenger being split and having administrative difficulties and being distributedly denied service because they are Right. In those cases, literally commercial, but they are officially managed services. On the other hand, I'm not sure that there's ever been anything that even approached IRC in terms of the quantity of people simultaneously engaged who can very easily find each other and join any of the tens of thousands of conversations that go on at once. So I can't tell you which one wins.
But most people are running AOL Instant Messenger instead of getting disconnects anyway.
But what really sucks is you have to choose from all this. You know, we've been split into four huge networks and then all these dozens of little ones. And, you know, okay, I want a channel that my friends are on, Pound Yak. And we've got three different networks linked now with my Linkbot, which is forbidden by the EFNet node that we're on, but we've been doing it for a few months and haven't been kicked from it. I'm thinking I'm banned from all the others. So we're going to do it as long as we can, you know, just because these are my friends and I want to sit and chat with them. And they've got their own reasons for being in different things. And it sucks that we can't have a meta namespace management thing that lets you manage channels and NICs and stuff, even if we have to prepend, you know, dialnet colon something, or, you know, specify which of these lower-level namespace management things we're talking about, and let you connect into those things as you need to. Some of the IRC clients now let you do this. The one on the Macintosh is nice. You can connect to different places and be in different channels. Yeah, but what was I trying to say? But what I would do, you know, if I could tweak the architecture, is Pound Yak would actually live on my server as far as the people connected and talking to each other. But the name servers would be somewhere else that lets them get their handles and whatever. And so, you know, where it's possible to take a group of people who are mostly in the Bay Area and let them connect mostly in the Bay Area for their physical conversations, and then it doesn't stress the backbone of the rest of the servers that maintain the namespace.
10 years ago, I think the IRC servers were already doing that. I believe that what just suggested over there actually had been done as part of the server code a very long time ago, because early on, anything that joined up, any nickname, any channel that was created, was propagated to the entire network, causing exactly what you said. Four people to get together on one private channel in, say, the Bay Area would go to Melbourne, which is obviously not a particularly good use of a transoceanic satellite link. And so what they did in one of the later versions of the server code is only servers who had users signed on participating in a given channel would have the contents of that channel conversation actually propagate over the network to them. So these people were pretty good at what they were doing in the server design all the way back then.
So servers connect in a tree. And I remember when that happened, they started joining the tree, but no one was beyond it.
Yeah, but, okay, so servers connect, you can view it as a tree the way they connect in. You're not sure which is the top node in the tree, but you can pick any one and it works. And they would trim the tree when the conversation wasn't needed any farther. And yet still, if two people were connected here and here, it would have to go bridging in between. And users don't really know how the things are connected. You're pretty clever if you bother to look.
IRC network is the appropriate description, because it is truly a network. A server could have four or five servers linked to it, and a downstream could have four or five servers linked off of it. And if you actually look at the tree structure, it actually looks more like a root structure of a tree, because it goes off in so many different directions. You were mentioning the ability of doing a channel that only certain people can connect to. Most people are used to a pound whatever for their channel names. IRC also supports another structure. If you precede it with a dollar sign, I believe that's the correct one, it's only visible on that server. Pound references the global network. Dollar sign references a specific network server. But there are a lot of other things most people don't recognize or don't use because they're such old commands. But IRC's been around for so long. I've personally been on it for over eight years. It's constantly being changed. It's actually now referred to as hybrid code.
Who uses IRC, or at least has at some point in the past? Keep your hands up. Who's been using it more than 1 year? Five.
10. Three of us. Were you involved in actually running it way back then, too? Nice to know it had a good impact on somebody.
I just wanted to say that I found it interesting. You called them pound channels. So I think when Avalon brought them in, they were hash channels.
Yeah.
So the Americans call that, you know, that crosshatch thing a pound. Huh.
Telecom industry trivia. Who knows what Ma Bell called those things?
You don't mean octocore.
Uh-huh. Give that man a cigar.
That was someone's joke.
Yeah, if you Google an octothorpe, you read the story, this guy at the Bell Company, I think in a reaction to how much bureaucratica there was around everything, just started using the name to see if anyone else would use it. And it's favorite, yeah.
The biggest reason why Americans call it pounds, because there's a lot of state and city channels started coming up, and the joke came along, says, pound Atlanta, pound New York, sounds like a good idea.
Take a look at a slightly internationalized U.S. keyboard, what you find is that the Shift 3, which has the pound or hash or octothorpe, also has a British pound sign as an alternate. And it depended on the mode your computer was in, whether it put the hash mark or an actual British pound sign.
Yeah, so I guess pound has a specific meaning in Australia for the U.K. currency. And also, I guess we didn't mind calling it hash channel because marijuana is legal in most Australian states.
What did you say?
Question I had was, anybody happen to know exactly how much current traffic on IRC is, where's binaries being traded these days? I mean, the amount of actual chat going on seems to have died way back. Yes, I know.
The actual server doesn't do the actual traffic. Most times it's set up as a direct ECC chat. The actual communications, an FNET server has to be able to sustain a continuous load of 5 megabit just to keep idle traffic going. Where's traffic? Basically, people get together and then they trade FTP sites. Yeah. It's actually probably only closer to 20% of what's actually used on it. The biggest thing on IRC is porn. Yeah. Yeah, okay, well, binaries. Yeah, then that would be, yeah, a majority. But again, it all depends upon which network you go on. Like I go on Open Projects. You don't find that there. It doesn't exist anywhere. Because most of it is, and it's a NIC registered channel, because most of the people that are on there are the people that originally created the code. And their name is a lot more recognizable, so they want to be able to register it. So if someone goes in as them, then you know if they're the real person or not, because they could change code.
Nickname registration and put it into the real world context, in essence what you've got is trademarking. In the real world we have massive international treaties and whole bodies of written and case law dealing with the interpretation of, well, you're using a word but it's affiliated with my company or my product and you're diluting me or you're damaging me, so you can't.
But all that stuff doesn't work either, so
Works better than some of the nickname stuff does on the IRC.
Well, thank you all for coming along. And I'd be interested to talk more with the people who are on there for a long time. I want to know what your nicks were. I want to know whether I knew you.